Hello and welcome to Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. This week's episode was recorded at the Fairway Gall Literary Festival in Sri Lanka. I caught up with a best-selling Sri Lankan author with unlikely literary beginnings. Born in Colombo, he read pure mathematics at Oxford, subsequently forging a career as a builder in London before becoming a writer. Now back home in Sri Lanka, he continues to design and build houses. He's a guest lecturer at the Colombo School of Architecture, and he hosts a national television programme on art and architecture. So, Ashok, just give us a snapshot of the country at the time that you were born.
I think at that stage there was a lot of optimism. It was quite soon after independence, so people were fresh. There was lots of money in the coffers. When Britain left, Sri Lanka was one of the wealthiest countries of the colonies per capita. I mean, Singapore was our poor cousin at that stage, and we love to boast about that. And where are we now? Anyway, that's how it was, optimism, etc. However, there was this return to what the French call authenticité, where there was this kind of yearning for all things Sri Lankan as opposed to colonial. Now, that went, in my opinion, way too far. For politically opportunistic reasons, one of the politicians said, Sinhala only. Overnight, the multicultural, multinational community, because it wasn't only just Sinhalese, Tamils, there were loads of other races, the Boras, the Gujaratis, there were many, many, many different small pockets of other nationalities here, and ones that are almost not heard of today. We say Muslims, but there were Muslims, there were Malays, there were Moors. Now, those three things sound similar, but they're not. They're from very different places. One lot from Southeast Asia, one lot from the original Arab traders who came here in the 12th century. So Sri Lanka has a very, very complicated social history.
So growing up, how did that affect you?
I think what happened was when this Sinhala-only thing came about, my family, for instance, is Catholic, so we felt marginalized, although we're Sinhala. My father took the first job that came along. He left when I was 8. On my 8th birthday, we went off to Somalia, which you might think of as the horror of horrors, but it was a beautiful place then. But that's not the point. He left with £5 sterling in his pocket. He had to cable, in those days there were cables, cable his boss and say, please meet me at the airport. I don't have enough money for a taxi to get to the hotel. That's how it was.
Relocating at that age, you're in Somalia, you're presumably already reading a lot. It's clear that you have a great love of literature. Where did that come from, and where did your travels take you from Somalia?
I think my love of literature really came from my parents, obviously. My mother was a journalist in those days. She had a beauty column, of all things, and she'd get proposals, little realizing that she was actually happily married, and then there was us lot. But they would write to her and say, dear Tilly, can we marry you, or can I marry you? So anyway, she had this column, so she had a love of literature. She was a great actress. She still is at the age of 91. God, I have trouble. And my father, in his quiet, bookish way, would hate, in parties, he'd slip away and go into the library, people's libraries, and sit there and read books rather than socialize. So I had that from then. Also, in Mogadishu, I have to say, I was enrolled in the American school, which had a fabulous library. They were not the Americans of today, I have to say. They were really young and vigorous and hopeful in a way that's sort of cynicism and so on and control that's crept in now, which wasn't there then. If you were halfway clever, you were told you could do classics or maths. And in my case, they were quite keen. I do classics at Oxford. My parents said, look, Latin and Greek, no relevance out in Sri Lanka. Sanskrit, yes, but that was not on the cards. So maths was foisted on me, I don't know. But I loved maths anyway. It was something I really, really loved maths, particularly pure maths. I couldn't be bothered with applied maths, which is more akin to physics, where you're working out structures, etc. Funnily enough, I end up now as a builder doing structures and so on. But that part bores me. What I'm really interested in is the beauty of numbers, the beauty of points and lines and dimensions. Mm-hmm. Still today, if I talk about it or in my writing, it's there, but it's heavily disguised because if I make it too overt, people start yawning and close the book. So For instance, in the book you've just read, The Professional, there's a lot of mathematics in there, but it's deeply, deeply hidden, buried, because I know it has to be subversively there. I cannot put it on the surface.
What did you do after Oxford?
Well, I didn't have a visa, and I wanted to stay on in England. So I had 8 or 9 years as working on building sites. That was the only job going then. It was the Thatcher years. The money was great. You could walk from one building site to another and they'd hire you. They knew you were below the whatever. They knew that they could pay you cash in the hand and you could just, you know, on Friday afternoon when they paid you, they could sack you if they wanted to and hire somebody else stronger than you, bigger than you, or less of a troublemaker, or somebody who might work for less money. So we went from place to place. So we worked laborers. Then I thought to myself, the first laboring job I had, I worked on a Victorian construction and I looked on it. It was a conversion. I thought to myself, in my naive, stupid way, I can do this. All it requires is one wall separating the staircase and two doors. Well, in fact, it involved a hell of a lot more. But I think you do have to be kind of foolish and naive in your life if you ever want to achieve anything. You can be too clever for your own good and say, I can't do that. Oh, God, no. How could I possibly do that? So anyway, I did.
So that was the start of a property developing career. What about writing, though? When did that start?
Okay, so I had written one or two short stories while I was still at Oxford, because I think Oxford was one of those places that encouraged you to go and listen in on other people's lectures. Not that I listened in on any English lectures, but I listened in on classics lectures, on philosophy. Pure maths had almost nothing to do with any of those things. But you went. It was the way you did things then. And you got a lot of juice out of the orange as a result. So, again, in my foolish way, I thought I'd love to write a story or two. And those stories have never seen the light of day. They're so bad. Reading them now, I think, my God, what was I thinking? So that was it. As a builder for those 8-9 years, I didn't write a single word, nor really did I read a single word. So you might think that's the worst thing you could do, but sometimes if you leave a field fallow, it produces a richer crop. And I think that's what happened. So I come back to Sri Lanka 2 months before my 31st birthday. I came back in July. My birthday is on the 1st of September. At the height of the building game, many of my friends had also gone into the building game. By then, property development or conversion was, everybody was doing it. Anyone who thought that they could do it, did do it. And by then, there were lots of immigrants, idiots like me, all of us idiots doing it, you know? And we were all making money. So I thought to myself, it was quite difficult for me to tear myself away from all that. But I forced myself. I cashed in my chips. I came back July 88. By August, the market had peaked. By December, it had crashed. And then my friends were calling me, and they went spectacularly bankrupt, my friends. And they said, how did you know? Well, I didn't know. Again, it's that foolish thing. You think, no, I must go back. I must go back and reconstruct this imaginary country that I've been dreaming about for so long. So, you know, you think there is somebody up there pulling strings. You really do think that at the end of the day, there was no reason why I should come back. But I did.
And started writing?
Well, no. That's the strange thing. For the next 12 years, I was designing and building houses. Now, there again, I had never designed and built a house in England. But I came back here. And by then, I was getting kind of interested in architecture. I never was, nor am I an architect. I'm just a common or garden builder. But I had kind of started getting interested in architecture. So I thought to myself, I can do that. So there again, that stupidity coming in. So I bought a tiny piece of land and I designed a house and built it. And of course, again, in my stupid, naive way, I recycled. Almost everything in that house was recycled, including the tiles on the roof, the old teak flooring I'd bought as salvage. The house had round columns, which many colonial houses had in Sri Lanka. I was laughed out of town by the architects because one of them said very loudly at a party to 10 other architects, he said, oh, but we are not slaves to the colonial mentality. Ha, ha, ha. And they all laughed. And I felt so small, I scurried away. Fast forward 20 years, now every architect here is building with recycled stuff. every architect. But at that stage, this was in 1988, it was a rare thing in Sri Lanka. So I did this for a few years. And then my father got cancer in 1998-99. And I would take him in a tuk-tuk to the cancer hospital in Maharagama. I couldn't afford to take him in a car. I'd take him in a three-wheeler. I would come back, put him into the room on the bed, and I would go next door, and with a pencil and paper, I would write. I don't know where that came from, but that first story in that first book, The Perfect House, wrote itself, I still remember, in about 35 minutes with a pencil in an exercise book.
For the benefit of listeners who haven't read your books, I mean, you're described as a man who gives us really a perfect snapshot of Sri Lankan society. Is that a fair way to describe your work?
It is. It's a double-edged sword, because then you begin to be known as a sort of society person who's chronicling the foibles, the eccentricities of the rich and famous. It is actually not the case. My wife, who is much more that, interestingly, and has a very varied and distinguished family in all walks of life, I was always known as Mandy's husband. Suddenly, when the book started making a name for themselves, it was different, and then everybody wanted to know me. But I have to tell you, till the books became known, I was just this little nobody from nowhere. But that was lovely, because having a certain degree of anonymity really helps your writing, particularly when you are chronicling all your aunties and uncles and people. This is a small place. Everybody is related or connected to everyone else. That beggar outside those doors, he is connected to me. The degrees of separation are possibly three. Maybe five, but more likely three. So, as a writer, you have this unseen eye watching you. And that's the trouble for writers in many South Asian countries. We are cramped in our style because we feel everybody is watching us and we're connected to everyone. So you write about a drunkard, naturally you're a drunkard. You write about a pedophile, naturally you're a pedophile. You know, so that constricts us in what we write. So, being somewhat unknown freed my hand quite a lot. But at the same time, being an outsider, I was able to observe these people in this society. These people, that sounds terrible, doesn't it? Do you know? I am one of these people. But I always felt, and still do, feel an outsider. Sri Lanka is one of the most complex countries in the world. You think of it as a lovely tropical island like Jamaica or Antigua or whatever. Boy, are you wrong. There are so many layers here, simply because it is so multicultural, so multilingual. And the politicians who would have us have a monolithic Sinhala Buddhist society are so wrong. That does a disservice to the truth of us, all of us. We are so layered and so complex. And as an outsider, I can sit here as a fly on the wall and observe this. And you get different answers. Depending on where we Sri Lankans are, we will answer you differently. So to get at the truth is very, very, very difficult. And on every side, even the war, you think what the West thinks of what happened in the war is so wrong. But quite often, we Sri Lankans, we keep our mouths shut. We don't say it. We think they're wrong. What do they know? But it's too much like hard work to make a fuss. So you just keep quiet and watch events unfold. I would say that any Sri Lankan, either Sinhala or Tamil, living abroad gets it wrong because they are not here. Many of our expat writers who come here for maybe 2 weeks and go back, watch out if they write about Sri Lanka because they will get it wrong. You need to live here.
Your books, I mean, you say that you were able to write from this position of anonymity, but of course that didn't last for long. You've won all the major Sri Lankan writing prizes.
Well, no, correction. I've been shortlisted for everything going. Always the bridesmaid, never the bride. But sadly, I love parties. I love food, principally. I'll go anywhere for the food. So then when you go somewhere and somebody takes a picture, then you end up in the newspaper. So that anonymity doesn't last very long. But you have to work outside of that somehow and still observe dispassionately this very complex society. And I have managed so far. And also, two nights ago, I read from my new book, which hasn't come out yet. It's called Cut Pieces. Sadly, it wasn't there on time for the festival. I read from that. And there was an entire piece against all these embassies. It's about how us Sri Lankans, we have such a hard time getting visas. And in the audience was the American ambassador, the French ambassador, the Italian ambassador. And I said out loud, I said, you know, listen, you lot, I said, this is the trouble we have getting visas to go to your countries. And I think I could see them squirming in their seats.
Tell us a little bit, just chronologically, if we could go through your books, because you're now on your sixth book. And I just wondered if there was a theme that runs through them all. I found The Professional, the one that I've read, hugely enjoyable. I mean, not only is it a snapshot of that time, but it's just a cracking read. And I get the impression that actually that's the case with all of them.
Absolutely, Georgina, you've hit the nail on the head. To me, as a creator of anything, and because I have two half strings to my bow, writing and building houses, I know this. I also lecture on the history of architecture and art, though I'm not qualified to do any of this stuff. My life is the world of the amateur, really, a rank amateur. But I know any art, in order to have validity to all of us, has to work on at least three levels, not one, not two. There is nothing so boring as a one-trick pony. So, a house, for instance, has to work as a piece of living sculpture, but it has to work in the volumes inside. When you walk through the rooms of a house, those volumes, the rooms, the volumes of those spaces need to sing to you a silent song. However beautiful a house, if it's expensive to maintain, if it has a flat concrete roof that leaks, for instance, people will leave it. So it has failed on the third level. It is not habitable. Likewise, in a painting, I won't go into all that because we'll be here all day, but in terms of writing, not only must it say something at its deepest level about the characters, about what you as a writer are trying to say, but it has to be a cracking good read, as you said, because if it doesn't, your reader will struggle through it, and the only people who love it are academics or critics who themselves will struggle through it, but they'll be ashamed to say that they didn't like it because they recognize some other intrinsic value in it, but they found it difficult and stodgy to read.
Where would you say your work fits into the canon of Sri Lankan literature in English?
I don't really know the answer to that, to tell you the truth, because we don't really have a very big canon of writing, and that is one of our biggest problems. Writing in English particularly, and that's what I'm talking about, English writing in Sri Lanka has had blow after blow with the Sinhala-only treatment of the politicians. But even today, there is this slightly Marxist idea that says that if you write in English and you're Sri Lankan, you are something of a traitor. It is not overtly there anymore. It was there 20 years ago when I was organizing as one of the committee members of the first Goa Festival. I would get calls at 11 o'clock at night saying, why are you being a traitor and putting your weight behind an English festival? Now, things have changed. I mean, that was, what, 10 years, 11 years ago? Things have changed, and it swung the other way. And many of our so-called enemies, within inverted commas, now love the festival, and they come there. Which just goes to show that if you work at it, if you keep at it, things will change. We don't have a very big canon of English writing in Sri Lanka. I would see myself, hopefully, on many different levels, as a chronicler of society here, but at a deeper level, as purely a novelist who is trying to express what is inside him. At that deepest level, I think a book has to be a standalone product that has actually nothing to do with Sri Lanka. It is a book because I felt as a writer that there was something I needed to say.
Now, you've made reference several times to the Fairway Gall Literature Festival, and you were deeply involved in setting that up. And of course, that's where we met, and we're talking here now back in Colombo in your amazing house. You're absolutely right. I never want to leave. But tell me about the festival.
Well, the very first meeting when the committee sat round was at my dining table years and years ago, as I said. But it has grown since then. And let me be clear, I have left. There is no committee now. That committee was dissolved for various reasons. I still can't understand why, but it was dissolved many years ago also. So I am no longer kind of a mover and shaker behind the scenes. But, because the team and so on keeps changing, I have found that myself and my wife, we've ended up as a sort of at the switchboard, and we get these calls coming through, and we redirect them to the people who need to answer them. Mm-hmm. So we're still there behind the scenes as people who were there at the start and who are always there for any curator, any director, anyone who comes along. We're always there. Whenever I go to Jaipur or any festival, I poach people. Shamelessly, I go up to them and say, would you like to come to the Golf Festival? If so, please give me your email, and I pass it on to whoever is organizing it that year. So shamelessly, I poach people for our festival because I still feel a kind of loyalty towards it. And why do I feel that loyalty? Because it has dragged us Sri Lankan writers kicking and screaming into the limelight. Because we can be very complacent here. It's an island. In that way, we are very like the West Indies. We are very inward-looking. We're very inward-looking. It's a very lush island. Nobody really starves here. It is not like the rest of South Asia. People are relatively well-educated. Infant mortality is low. Maternal mortality is low. We have one of the highest quality of life indicators of any emerging countries. It's a very, very high lifestyle within this kind of very supposedly poor, within quotes, country. So the bad side of that is that we're very complacent and we think arrogantly that nobody can teach us anything. Wrong. As writers, we are 20 years behind Indian writers. And I will say this again and again and again. Why? Because the Indian diaspora is huge. So people started writing Indian novels in English because there was a market. When I first wrote my first book, at that stage, I had a little bit of dynamism in me. I sent it to about 3 or 4 English publishers, all of whom loved it. But they said, we're really sorry, there is nowhere we can place it. We feel it's a niche market. So one of the things that the festival has done is gained us a little bit more recognition. And I was invited to Bhutan, where somebody heard me read and said, I would like to represent you. And I then found out she was the best agent in India, Meeta Kapoor. And then she almost instantly got me a publisher, Random House as it was then, for the entire backlist. But still to this day, I do not have a Western publisher. So it is only sold in South Asia. But one has to wait. These things take time.
And of course, you have all of these foreign authors coming in to speak at the festival, which I should just describe as in Gaul, which is a fort town. So you've got this beautiful town right on the sea. You've got this concentration of brilliant minds. You've got an incredibly diverse audience. I was very, very struck by how articulate, engaged, and how broad it was, what a broad demographic the audience was. All of this coming together to make this fantastic week.
Yes, absolutely. And I do get invited to a lot of festivals in South Asia. And I have to say, on that score, we win hands down. Nobody has a walled fort on the edge of the sea, on the edge of the Indian Ocean, no less, where you can have these brilliant people coming. And that's the other point. Having brilliant minds coming from elsewhere is something so necessary for us because we tend to get so claustrophobic and so stale within the walls of that fort. We need this fresh blood that comes in, and we love it, absolutely love it. But in terms of placing this festival amongst other festivals, it's a small festival. It's a slightly chaotic festival. I don't think anyone would doubt that. And even 20, 30 years down the line, I'm telling you with my hand on my heart, however efficient we would try to make it, the chaos is in our genes. That is us. You know, better get used to it because it ain't going to change.
In terms of those minds coming in, just I think it's worth mentioning some of the highlights of the festival, as well as the local writers. People, for instance, the Booker Prize winner Richard Flanagan was here, Alexander McCall Smith, Lord David Putnam.
Absolutely. And with Lord Putnam, for instance, he gave us a 45-minute solo session, which was astounding. Alexander McCall Smith, I really do love that man. You know, it's amazing how you can be, again, such a good person on one level and still manage to write stuff that is so amazingly funny and insightful. and true and true to what he writes. Mm. Richard Flanagan, wonderful stuff, so deep and yet so gently said, with no arrogance about it. We Sri Lankans, we have a lot to learn from these great minds. And in the normal course of events, we would never see these people. And they wouldn't possibly think of coming to us because we are such a backwater. But with a festival like this, it gives us all an excuse to meet each other. And then Justine Picardy, again, marvelous, absolutely marvelous. And with a true kind of love for, I think, our society now, having seen it.
And of course, Dame Maggie Smith. One thing that I noticed throughout the festival, and I wonder how much this was influenced by you, is that there was a really, really strong architectural theme. There were walks every day with a leading architect. There were talks. There's some amazing architecture within Gaul. And that strand of the program was absolutely fascinating.
Yes, and that is absolutely no thanks to me. It is something that's always existed. And it's a strange thing about Sri Lanka. I think architecture is one branch of the arts where Sri Lanka punches way above its weight because we're such a small place. But for some strange reason, always, there has been excellent architecture, up to and including a lesser-known name like Minette da Silva, who was Asia's first modern woman architect. Nobody knows that. But somebody's actually writing a fictional novel about it. But nobody knows it. So there are lots of absolute architectural gems. Jeffrey Bava is the obvious one. But there's a whole new generation of modern architects like Channa Daswata or Arjalendran or many, many others. I could name you 10 names, all of whom deserve to be on the world stage.
And of course, you know more about this than most because you present and have done on and off for years television shows about art and architecture.
Yes, and there again, it's a sort of cunning, subversive ploy to get young people interested in the arts. Because sadly, we also do have the very, very Asian mentality. It's okay for your son to be an artist. My son will be, or my daughter will be, a doctor, a lawyer, an engineer, or an accountant. My father was an accountant, and my mother, I think, is to blame for all this because she said, she always told us, if you ever become an accountant, I will shoot you, she said. You know, she was very artistic and so on. So the program was there to try and encourage young people to take an interest in the arts. It became quite a cult show. And I would go off to, say, Anuradhapura, which is very, very far away. And the waiter at the little hotel I was staying at would say, oh, sir, we watched your program. We watch your program. We love it, etc. Quite often, for entirely the wrong reasons. Many people watched it because they found it an easy way to learn English. And I would think, yes, another level. It's working on another level. It's not just about the arts, but people are actually watching it to learn English.
What's next for you?
Gosh, so many things. I really have to cut back. There is also a book inside me. There is a novel that's been rattling around for the last year. I've written the last paragraph of it, in case I forget. But that's all that's written. The rest of it is at least 3 years away. But I do have to sit down and start, because until you start, you can't finish.
Ashok Ferry's work is published by Penguin India. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of George McDonough and Christy Evans. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud, or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.